Welcome to the Psychology Podcast, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. I'm Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. Today, it's great to have Adam Grant on the podcast. Adam is an organizational psychologist warden, where he has been the top-rated professor for 7 straight years. He is the number one New York Times bestselling author of 4 books that have sold millions of copies and been translated into 35 languages. His work has been praised by J.J. Abrams, Bill and Melinda Gates, among many others. Grant's TED Talks have been viewed more than 20 million times, and he hosts the chart-topping TED podcast Work Life with Adam Grant. He's been recognized as one of the world's 10 most influential management thinkers, Fortune's 40 Under 40, Oprah's Super Soul 100, and a World Economic Forum Young Global Leader. Adam received distinguished scientific achievement awards from the American Psychological Association and the National Science Foundation. He was in Philadelphia, woohoo, go Philly, with his wife Allison and their 3 children. Adam, so great to have you on the Psychology Podcast again.
I'm so glad to be back, Scott. Thank you for the overly generous introduction, and especially for building a bridge between all the great research that's done in psychology, including by you, and the rest of the world, which I feel like 20 years ago, when I was an undergrad, reading all these interesting studies that were collecting dust in journal articles, if I knew there were going to be people like you out there making sure that not only a good research got done, but also that it got shared, I would have been much more optimistic about the future of scientific psychology than I was.
Well, that's really generous of you to say that. It's funny, I view you that way. So I guess that's a nice mutual thing there. you know, I'm just reflecting because you were one of the first psychology podcast guests ever. You were so kind enough to kind of take a chance on the Psychology Podcast in 2014, but my, have we both grown since 2004? I mean, I could speak for myself at least. I was such a awkward geek, and now I'm like 50% less of an awkward geek, but I'm still, there's still 50% there. But do you remember like who we were in 2014? Do you remember these people?
I think I might have had more hair, so I didn't grow in that direction. But I remember, I think I was on maybe the second edition of the iPad, trying to figure out how to make a podcast recording even work at that time, which was completely foreign to me. And yeah, you've just taken off. It's amazing.
Oh, likewise. So I really am excited to talk about your new book today. It's really a good book. It's like, I genuinely mean that. It's a really good book, and it's much needed right now. In fact, you say, and I couldn't agree more with the sentence, I can't think of a more vital time for rethinking. Wow, what a time we're living right now. As you put it in the introduction, you know, there's so many crises, there's so many fires going on right now. How do you think, first of all, what is rethinking, and how do you think rethinking can help, if not put out the fires, not stoke them more?
Oh, where do we begin? I think, well, first of all, I had a really hard time titling this book at first, because I thought that in many ways, what I wanted to do was I wanted to get people to hit the reset button on the knowledge they took for granted, the assumptions they held but hadn't questioned, the opinions that might have even become part of their identity. And I just felt like so many of the titles that came to mind were either a little bit cheesy. Like, how many times have we been encouraged to hit the reset button, right? Or they were just a little bit too contemplative. Like, you know, second thoughts was one that came to mind. And one morning I woke up and I said, oh, think again. That's what we do as social scientists, right? Our job is to think again. And it means that the first thoughts that we've had, the initial ideas that we've gotten excited about, are not necessarily the best ideas. And maybe they were yesterday, right? But the world might have changed in a way that makes yesterday's ideas a little bit stale and irrelevant. And so I guess for me, rethinking is a skill set that starts with intellectual humility, right? Knowing what you don't know, and recognizing how many areas of ignorance you have in your life and how likely it is that you're wrong about many of the things that you believe to be true. And then from there, what I want to get to is people having a healthy level of doubt and being curious about what they don't know. And the hope is that that leads them to make new discoveries. And that only reinforces their humility and reminds them that there is so much more to learn.
You know, a lot of what you're describing sounds like the scientific mindset, you know, what we're trained to do in the sixth grade science class. You know, like we take chemistry and then we forget it, and then unless you go into the field of science, you know. But even when you go into the field of science, many scientists don't think like that outside of the laboratory, right? Actually, let's talk about that a second. Let's double click on that.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I think that's a tragedy. Yeah. And as you know, in some ways I wrote Think Again to try to help people think more scientifically about their own beliefs, right? Which to your point, we know a lot of brilliant scientists who don't apply the same humility, curiosity, mental flexibility to their daily lives that they bring to their labs. And I think that's unfortunate. I also think that those of us who are not trained as professional scientists, we can actually learn something from thinking more like scientists. So I guess my original inspiration for this came from work by our colleague Phil Tetlock, who wrote about how we just spend way too much time thinking and talking like preachers, prosecutors, and politicians. And being in preacher mindset is about saying, I've already found the truth, and my job, Scott, is to proselytize it to you. Prosecutor mode is in some ways the mirror image. I know you're wrong. I have to prove it and win my case. And we don't do a lot of rethinking when we're in preacher or prosecutor mode, right? Because if I already know that I'm correct and you're incorrect, then there's no reason for me to do any moving. All I have to do is change your mind. And Phil wrote about politician mode as being a little bit different in the sense that you're trying to campaign for the approval of some audience. And that might look like you're a little more flexible because you cater to what they want to hear. But sometimes you're doing that at the wrong time for the wrong reasons, not because you've really changed your mind, but because, you know, you're just trying to appease whatever that stakeholder group is. And so I think about scientific thinking as an alternative, to start with the idea that many of your beliefs are actually just hunches. They're theories that are waiting to be tested. They're hypotheses that might be falsified. And what you could do then is go out into the world and ask yourself, okay, what experiment do I need to run in my life? What data or observations do I need to collect in order to figure out whether my hypotheses are true or false? And I think if people took that mindset a little bit more seriously, they'd be able to get out of confirmation bias, get out of desirability bias, and say, you know what, I should spend as much time looking for reasons why my opinions are false as I do kind of hanging out in my echo chamber or filter bubble looking to validate what I already believe. What do you make of all that?
It's such a good point because, you know, where we're trained as science, we're trained to actively disconfirm our hypothesis. I mean, if we know that what's left after if we can make sure that we haven't discovered all these things that are disconfirming our quote brilliant idea, you know, then we can have more confidence, you know, at a p less than, you know, whatever. But so that's the way we're taught, but that's not the way that anyone is acting in the world. Right?
No, and I immediately got curious when I said, okay, what if we could all do a little bit less preaching, prosecuting, and politicking, and a little more scientific thinking? Could that work for non-scientists? Can we actually teach this frame of mind? And conveniently, there was actually an experiment with entrepreneurs where over 100 founders of Italian startups, they're all pre-revenue, are randomly assigned to either a control group or a scientific thinking group. They go through a few months of entrepreneurship training, and the training is identical, except for the fact that the scientific thinking group is told, you know what, your vision and strategy for your startup, that's just a theory. And what you should do is try to identify the hypotheses you have about how you're going to capture your market, and then go and do customer interviews to flesh out exactly what those hypotheses are. And then when you do your little product launch, or you create a minimum viable product, or you test out your service, that's an experiment to find out whether your hypotheses were true or false. And you can immediately start to see the benefit of that. The data, I think, though, were really striking in that the control group averaged less than $300 of revenue that year. The experimental group, just getting that scientist lens, averaged over $12,000 in revenue in that year, which is that's a whopping effect. Huge. And the main mechanism was just pivoting, that If you were taught to think like a scientist, as an entrepreneur, you were more than twice as likely to abandon your old strategy and say, you know what? That wasn't working. Let me find something that does. And I think that kind of flexibility is exactly at the heart of thinking like a scientist.
Yeah, I'm listening to you talking now, and it just strikes me that a lot of your work is talking about characteristics that that maybe in the past before you came along, like they sound nice, you know, but they're not. Why are they relevant, you know, in the workplace, you know, like be kind. Yeah, yeah, okay. My mother told me that when I was 10 years old, you know, or like, you know, have humility, have intellectual humility. Okay, yeah, yeah, okay, yeah. But that person's an asshole. No, but I feel like you're actually coming along and you're saying, well, look, these characteristics, like, you know, like basically you're saying, think again about the kindness, think again about thinking again, you know, like, you know, is this, you know, right? This seems to be a kind of a common theme or a thread that weaves across. Have you thought about it that way?
You know, I didn't see it at all until I'm trying to remember. I think it was 2016. A reporter had interviewed me about some of my research. And afterwards she said, you know, you're just a giant Trojan horse. I'm sorry, tell me more. I've never been called that before. I don't know.
Go on.
Exactly. Like, I would really like to know what you think I'm smuggling into, you know, into some forbidden gates. And she said, "Well, what you're constantly doing in your work is you're motivating the things that you study by their ability to drive success and excellence. But the payoff is actually a better you." And so the initial hook is, well, here's how you can become, you know, here's how you can become more effective at whatever you do. But the path, I guess, that I keep studying there is a virtuous path, right? That at some level, I want you to be more generous, more curious, more humble. And I want to study how those virtues could actually go hand in hand with success. So I think you're onto something, Scott. And it's interesting because this is also a theme in your work. You've written just several now fascinating articles and brought some data together about bright side personality traits as opposed to the dark triad that we like to talk about in psychology. And you've also been highlighting how some of these lighter side traits can be associated with success. Was this more intentional on your part than it was on mine?
Well, I certainly can't say if it was more intentional in comparison to you, but I can say it was intentional on my part, for sure. We felt, and I don't want to redirect the conversation to myself all of a sudden, but I'll just say at Penn, there were some amazing colleagues like David Yaden, Elizabeth Hyde, Eli Tsekanama, who's now at University of Hawaii. He worked with Andrew Duckworth on the original Grit paper. We just all felt like just assholes got too much attention in the personality psychology literature. You know what I mean? Like when you look at the personality psychology, it's like, for instance, the journal Paid Personality and Individual Differences, every single article is dark triad in this, dark triad in this, mating, dark triad in the workplace, And I went exasperated to my, you know, friend David Yaden's office, and I said, is there anything that's interesting about someone who's not an asshole? And so that was the question. That was the question motivating that personality psychology research. But I feel like there was probably a greater intentionality than you're giving yourself credit for in your own work about it, right? Because once you discovered like that, for instance, give and take, when you were doing that research, and you discovered that, my gosh, like this is such a predictive variable that maybe I didn't even realize how predictive it was. You wanted to then, your motivation was to share that information in the world, right? And show them.
Definitely. I definitely was interested in that specifically, right? So I came in thinking, okay, do you really have to be selfish to be successful? Isn't it possible that there are ways to achieve your goals while being unselfish or even generous? Right. I don't think I saw, though, the larger pattern, right, that idea of linking character and success was going to keep threading throughout my work. So I knew I was doing that with studying givers, takers, and matchers, and that part of it was deliberate. I didn't know that I was playing the same tune, though, when I went on to study other topics. And it either I was chasing it implicitly or it's been following me ever since.
So fascinating. Okay, so I kind of want to I want to stay on this topic for a second. Because creativity is another one, right? That you did, and so the triumphant. I like these three. I like these three. Compassion. I'm reframing giving as compassion. I hope you'll allow me that license for a moment.
It's all yours.
It's not we could get into the nuances of why that's probably not.
No, they're near cousins, and they both belong to the pro-social family.
Pro-sociality.
So it's totally fair.
We should just say pro-sociality. Creativity and you know, rethinking a new construct. I want to give you credit here for. You know, I'm not just going to say something else like, oh, an intellectual humility, because that's not quite the same thing. I mean, you've really come up with a new construct here, and that's what I want to talk to you a lot about today and how that...
Do you think so?
I do. I actually think you came up with a new construct, and I wanted to talk to you about its correlations and linkages to, like, the Big Five and stuff, and I thought we could nerd about that today, but I really do think that it's not reducible to, if I just said, like epistemic humility. You know, it's like, no, that's not quite it, you know, the intellect facet of openness experience. No, not really. You look at those items, it's like, I like philosophical discussions. You can like philosophical discussions and never rethink anything in your entire life, right?
Like, I mean, I feel like that's most of academia. People having rich, abstract conversations that confirm what they already believed.
That's right. That's right. So these three things, rethinking, creativity, and pro-sociality, that gets us a nice start with the whole virtuous eudaimonia path of life, doesn't it? Creative actualization.
Yeah, I think it does. So what's missing? I think integrity is probably missing.
And that you're just like, oh, there's a lot of like cans like we're opening up, and it's like, wait, which can do I want to focus on? Because that's all the authenticity question's fascinating one,
yes.
And I think that both me and you are kind of moving more in the direction of like, it's really integrity, like authenticity is really more about integrity, you know, and that's how Eric Fromm thought of it. So I do think that that's a good one. That's probably missing. Okay, these four. Okay, let's say if we just we build like an artificial intelligence robot with these four, and think about what could be missing. Well, obviously we give them vision, but
that's
like obvious. Yep. But then we give a robot, we give an AI, you go to Carnegie Mellon, we program a robot that has these four characteristics. Maybe. You know, maybe the one thing that I'm trying to see how it fits into this picture is emotional intelligence, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like, because that's not quite the same thing as pro-sociality either, right?
No, it's not.
Yeah. Do we want to add that one?
You're right.
Do we want to make these five, the Big Five, our new Big Five?
you know, it's interesting. I don't know what to do with emotional intelligence here because I think about it much more in the ability and skill category. And I'm thinking about the other attributes you listed as more motivational, as more will do as opposed to can do. So maybe we need a couple of different families, right? Mm-hmm. So what we've been building are our strengths of character. There's also probably a set of strengths of skill.
That's I like that. And then, you know, we would want to put a grit maybe. Is that a skill? Is grit? But then that's tricky, right? It's like a compound trait. I feel like grit is a compound trait between skill and motivation because it is a skill.
Yeah.
It is a skill in a way. You know, it's a muscle.
There's probably a skill component of all of these now that you
right?
mentioned it. There's a really interesting Dudley and Cortina paper on organizational citizenship behavior and the knowledge and skill component saying, look, we don't care how motivated you are to help other people. Mm. If you don't have relevant expertise to share, you're not going to be that helpful. Yeah. And if you don't know how to offer help without making people feel stupid or undermining their self-reliance and making them feel dependent, then you're probably also not going to end up being that successful in your efforts to support others. And we could probably do that analysis for each of these. There's a will component and a skill component. But maybe Angela Duckworth, who we've both spent a lot of time with, would say, okay, there's strengths of heart, mind, and will. And we could say the pro-sociality clearly fits in the heart category. The will would be, that's where I would put grit, I guess. And rethinking and creativity both feel like strengths of mind. Where does integrity belong?
You know, it almost seems like that's like a superordinate category, you know, for any of these things, couldn't you not have integrity in any of those domains, right? You could, you see what I'm saying? It almost seems like that's like the meta virtue in a way one maybe could make a case.
So talk to me a little more about your authenticity view of integrity. I'm asking in part because in the organizational world, Roger Mayer and his colleagues have defined integrity as having and enacting worthy principles. So they want to know, you know, at least when they ask, are you trustworthy? The integrity dimension of that is, okay, do we believe that you have decent values? And then also that you're going to enact the values that you espouse. You're going to live by the principles that you, I guess you're going to practice what you preach effectively. And I think your integrity stance is a little bit different through an authenticity lens.
It is. And this is a good discussion. When I was constructing the self-actualization scale, trying to like test to see which of Maslow's characteristics of self-actualizers actually could hold up psychometrically, my items in authenticity were adapted from the way he thought about authenticity and the way that Eric Fromm, the humanistic psychologist at that time, thought of authenticity, which was simply this. I stay true to my values specifically under conditions in which they're threatened. The reason why I like thinking about it that way, and I want to get your thoughts. I really don't want to turn the spotlight back on me in this chat. You're the interviewee, but I'd love to get your thoughts on this and how you think about this. But I feel like things like courage, right? Like, why would you just measure courage by saying on a scale of 1 to 5, I have courage? It's like, no, you have courage. It's easy to have courage when courage is not really needed, you know. But it's a lot harder to have courage when it's truly requires courage. And I almost see authenticity in a similar sort of way. It's easy to just say, you know, whatever's on your mind when you have supporters who would burn down the White House for you, so to speak, you know, for example. I don't know where I got that example, but it's easy to kind of say whatever you want when you have devoted sycophants. But it seems to me like authenticity and integrity, the related construct there, is something that comes about when you can really have that strength of muscle to say, no, this is my value, and I'm going to stick to this value, even though everyone wants me to not stick to it. I don't know. What are your thoughts on this?
I think this is a great way to think about values and virtues more generally, because they're all easy to live when they're not being tested. Right. It's incredibly easy to be kind when you're in a good mood and when things are going your way, right? It's very easy to be creative when you have access to lots of ideas and a lot of support around you. I think it would be interesting to actually think about studying and measuring values through this lens and say, okay, the real test of whether you live by a value as opposed to just claiming it is whether you stick by it when the deck is stacked against you.
Yeah, I really, really like that. I wish the field moved more in that direction, because the field I'm talking about, positive psychology, because I feel like a lot of these constructs are just acontextual, right? They're like, you take a questionnaire, like the VIA survey, these are your top character strengths, but it's like they're acontextual, mm-hmm. right? It's like there's something that's not deeply satisfying about that.
Yeah, I want to measure whether you're a giver or a taker by how you treat someone on your worst day as opposed to your best.
I love that. Or how do you treat a subordinate? Like for instance, you know, narcissists are huge givers when it comes to people that they know they can get something out of, right? So if you just look at that context, right, they're such a giver. But then how do a lot of these people treat, you know, like we found light triad, dark triad, one of the biggest things differentiating light triad versus dark triad was how you treat, do you treat all individuals with dignity and respect, or do you only the dark triad individuals who scored high on the dark triad, I should say, because we all have a little bit of it within us, right? They were very much like, you know, I treat people with dignity and respect who are powerful. I treat people with powerful people with dignity and respect. It's like, does that really make you a great human being overall as a whole person?
Not last time I checked. It reminds me of the Ruse Vonk paper on the slime effect, where people were essentially kissing up and kicking down. Mm. They were extremely likable and flattering towards superiors, but then not so kind and respectful towards subordinates. And it almost sounds like, it reminds me a little bit of the classic Adorno work on the F scale of authoritarianism, where if you acted submissive with superiors and dominant with subordinates, that was a marker of being an authoritarian. And I wonder if that's part of what you're capturing that differentiates dark and light triad tendencies.
It could be. It could be. And I definitely think about that more. But I want to return to rethinking your really cool new construct, because it's really worthy of airing here and getting some air. So I took your test, and you have a think again quiz, and my score was 50% scientist, 30% politician, 10% prosecutor, and 10% preacher. And I got 0% in the other category. Is it possible to get something in the other category?
Yeah. First of all, I haven't done systematic validation work on these items. I adapted them from some items in a few relevant literatures and then wrote a bunch of new ones myself. But it's really just designed as a fun way for people to reflect on their own styles and when they might be more likely to slip into preaching or prosecuting or politicking versus science. But yeah, there are some red herring items in there. Like if you said that you wanted avocado toast, I didn't have a category for that.
So I was on the fence about that one, but decided I chose the other option, be curious about what I don't know. But
let's talk about your scores for a second. No, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no. I was just going to mention some other of the, I was on the fence about some of your funny ones because I was like, oh, but I do like that. But I was like, no, but I was like, come on, Scott, focus. You want to really know what your score is. But let's talk. What were you going to say?
No, so I'm surprised that your scientist score wasn't higher because
I'm surprised too.
you're so passionate about thinking scientifically in almost every part of your life, to my knowledge. I that could be an indictment of my items being flawed. I wonder also, though, it's interesting that politician is your next highest because you've talked about how agreeable you are and how historically it's been extremely important to you to be liked. And I wonder if we're picking that up a little bit in your politician score, that there are situations where you might adjust what you claim your opinion to be in order to fit in with the group around you.
That's really interesting. I saw the politician 30% score as my interest in like public science outreach and persuading people of the importance of this kind of stuff. But you did hit on something that I'm working through with my therapist.
It sounds like I need the same therapist, so tell me more.
So you did hit on something there, Adam. But no. I think there could be some truth to that. But I've really tried to work on the integrity thing as much as possible, in my life. And it does raise an interesting question. What's the relationship between integrity and can you have a 30% politician score and still have integrity? Isn't that an interesting question? Like, can you be a good politician? I think it's a relevant question to the moment we're seeing, right? Like, can you be like I get the sense, and I was talking to some senator. I was in this like inaugural ball, virtual ball last night with like senators, and actors. And so it's the strangest thing. But anyway, and they were talking and they were saying how they're like, well, we've known Joe Biden for years and years, and regardless of the politics that we disagree, there were some Republicans. I think there might have been some Republicans. Regardless of the politics, he's a man of integrity. He's a man. He's a really kind, caring, like authentically. Yet at the same time, in order to do the work he has to do right now to unite America, he has to at least be 30% in your test, right? So do you see what I'm saying? Like, how can you balance those two things?
Yeah. Yeah, it is a very timely question. I'm not sure if I have a simple answer to it, but I think one of the things I've been thinking about lately on, I guess, on this dimension is it's almost impossible to be true to all the parts of your character at the same time, right? Because we're so complex and multidimensional. And I wonder if part of what it means to be a politician who acts with integrity is being true to your core values while being false to your personality from time to time. So I look at Joe Biden's an interesting example. I don't know his big five personality traits. I do know that he overcame a stutter and that he's described, whether it was because of the stutter or just a compounding factor for the stutter, being very shy at first, right? And he's had to overcome that. I assume in service of his values of both advancing his own political career and also trying to promote the common good the way that he sees it as a politician. And I think there's some clear integrity in doing that. You could say he's being very authentic to some values that are important to him. There are probably moments where he feels extremely inauthentic. I can't imagine that every single time he gets on stage, he thinks, yes, this is me. This is who I was born to be. The same way that a George W. Bush or Bill Clinton probably did.
I love this discrepancy between integrity sometimes and like choosing the integrity option over the biological personality disposition option. I really like what you're saying, and it's cool because it's you don't hear about people talking about that discrepancy. I think we had like lunch one time and you made some comment like, I'm temperamentally an introvert, but I do you remember that? I think you said, am I allowed to say this on air?
Yeah, of course.
And that struck me, you know, it strikes me right now as relevant to the conversation, you know, how sometimes you probably feel like, even though biologically you don't feel like you really want to go out there on that stage or go to the networking meeting, you know, like you're reacting like physically, you're breaking out in sweat. Like at least I know that's how I feel when they say, Scott, yeah, you want to go to a break, you know, like a networking event. I almost said a breakdancing event, which I don't know why I almost said that.
I might actually like that better, and that's not an endorsement of me ever breakdancing.
Hilarious. Right?
It's just, I'm like, networking event? I'm sorry. I have a great network. It's Ethernet. It's wired in my house. I'm good. Thank you. No thanks.
Yeah. But you still do it. Yeah, you still act anyway. And that's the point here.
Yeah. I mean, that gets to the heart for me of... I didn't choose my personality. Mm. Right? I didn't choose to have the dopamine response pattern of an introvert, right? I did choose my values. I did choose my passion for sharing ideas and teaching and learning from other people. And it's the same thing that I've watched Brian Little do his whole career when he talks about acting out of character and says, look, I'm gonna go into pseudo extroversion mode because I have a personal project that matters deeply to me. And I think if we agree that personality is, you know, largely a set of biological tendencies that you didn't choose, and values are principles that you decided are important to you, I know which one I'm going to let win when there's a conflict between the two.
I think that's authenticity. You know, in a way that that maybe most people don't think of as authenticity, but I think it's almost true authenticity in a way. I guess that's the question: is in authenticity, who are you being authentic to? What part of yourself?
Yes. I think what's interesting about that, and I didn't see this until you just brought it up, is it passes your difficulty test. Because the easy road would be to say, you know what, I'm an introvert, I'm not going to put myself in situations that require me to act extroverted. And yet, I'm choosing those situations anyway because I have a goal and a set of values that I care about. And that makes me think that that feels more like integrity than just saying, I don't feel like networking. I'm not going to network.
Right. So you say like a little knowledge can be a dangerous thing. Now, how can a little knowledge be a dangerous thing?
Well, I think this goes to one of the wrinkles in the Dunning-Kruger effect, which yeah, I think anybody who has a passing interest in psychology is just endlessly interested in, right? It's the, you know, the finding. Well, it's the classic pattern is the people who have the least knowledge or skill in a domain are the most likely to overestimate their expertise in that domain. So the people with the poorest grammar and the lowest emotional intelligence are the most likely to be overconfident about exactly how brilliant their writing is and how emotionally skilled they are. And I think when I first learned about Dunning-Kruger, this is just over two decades ago now. So half my life ago, when I learned about Dunning-Kruger, I thought it meant that complete beginners were the most overconfident. Mm. But that's not the pattern in the data. If you know literally nothing about an area, then it's pretty easy to see that. What David Dunning has shown in some of his studies is that when you start to gain a little bit of knowledge, your confidence climbs faster than your competence. And you can, it's almost like you confuse the rate of learning that you have with the level of expertise that you have. And they've done some, Dunning and Sanchez, I love this paper, they did this experiment where people are in a simulated zombie apocalypse and they have to be doctors basically to rescue or treat and cure humans who have been, I guess, bitten by zombies. And at first, there's, you know, nobody knows what they're doing and nobody's confident. And then they start to get a little bit better. And all of a sudden, they think they're extremely good. And you see this widening gap between their skill, which is going up a little, and their confidence, which is going up a lot. And I think that's why a little knowledge can be a dangerous thing, is once you know something, you can start to believe, because you know more than you used to and because you know more than some other people do, you can start to convince yourself that you're actually pretty darn informed on this topic.
What about, you know, this idea of overconfidence? Can you know too much? Because like so much of your research looks at inverted U-shaped curves. This is like your thing. does this apply to the same thing with knowledge?
Yeah, Eric Dane wrote a great paper about this on what he called cognitive entrenchment.
Hmm.
And he showed that when it comes to, at least when it comes to a bunch of different domains, I don't know, he argued that this is a general phenomenon. I'm excited to see more research on this, but the basic argument was that if you are extremely knowledgeable or experienced in a domain, that you fall into this trap of cognitive entrenchment where you start to take for granted assumptions that need to be questioned, and you become a fish that doesn't even know it's in water. And the data on this are kind of cool. So some of the studies that he cites speak to, okay, so one would be expert bridge players. If you change the rules a little bit, they actually play worse than novices because they have such a hard time unlearning the strategies that have always worked for them. And highly skilled accountants, if you change tax laws, are actually slower to adapt than really inexperienced accountants who are learning these tax laws for the first time. And so it does make me think that there's a risk of rigidity when you develop a lot of expertise and you're deeply immersed in a set of assumptions or approaches to a field. And I wonder if this is one of the reasons that whether you're an entrepreneur trying to disrupt or whether you're a scientist trying to bring in a revolutionary new theory, that we sometimes see big, bold ideas come from a slightly outside perspective, yeah, as opposed to inside the field.
I think that's so quite right. And that links to creativity as well. You see a lot of outsiders. Us outsiders are really, really creative and innovative, you know, immigrants.
Go on.
I just said immigrants in particular. I always found that research really interesting. They're very innovative. But what were you going to say?
Fascinating. Yeah. No. I was going to say you and our brilliant colleague Reb Rebeli have some research on this, right? About how having broad interests, yeah, is actually associated with creativity.
That's correct. Reb and I have collected so much data on this that we're overwhelmed with a paper. We have like four studies, and it's like now we got to write this up. but diversity of interest is that's right. Diversity of interest is a topic we've been really interested in for quite some time. So let's think about your, I don't want to lose sight of your construct and the uniqueness of your construct, thinking again. So is thinking again, that's still not quite the same thing as diversity of interest, but you could see how they'd be allied as well. You know, they'd be they're cousins, you know, but thinking again, you know, I almost am thinking like if I was the cognitive scientist again, like that's my training was in cognitive science. Like I bet there's a relationship between like the updating component of working memory. And have you thought about it at that level of granularity
and thinking again
and the ability to think again? Yeah.
No, that's such an interesting way to think about it, though. Yeah. You're right. You could.
Like the NBAC task.
Yeah. You know, you could measure people's either will or skill to think again by looking at how quickly they're able to discard old memories and accommodate new ones.
That's what I'm thinking.
Right? Which would be a really objective way of capturing that. You're right, the cognitive underpinnings of this orientation.
But that's like the cognitive science we train nerd in me. That's like, oh, I bet we could. Like if I was still doing a dissertation, that's a dissertation top. Like someone could do that dissertation.
Do you think that's different from actively open-minded thinking? Because that felt like the closest. What I wanted to do with Think Again was to capture a mindset that had, you know, a series of elements attached to it, right? And say, okay, you know, there's the humility, there's the curiosity, there's the doubt, there's the updating, right? And this is a cycle that we go through that that helps protect us against overconfidence. It seemed like actively open-minded thinking was the construct that got closest to at least what's at the center of that cycle. Do you see a difference between the two?
I see it again. I guess see it as allied. I see all of these Kistanovich kind of rationality skills as allied as well. And I'm trying to go through my head like my side bias. It's not quite the same thing, but it's related. I feel like there's.
Yeah.
I feel like you've added another thing to the table of the rationality Stanovich kind of like circle of things that are really important in order, because so many people have the my side bias right now, right? Like, they really only interpret arguments in through the lens of their own side. But the idea of like constantly update, it's funny, the closest, this is the really how nerdy I am, Adam, because the closest thing construct I could think of to what you're talking about was the end back task. No, that's really nerdy. That's really nerdy. But the point is there's something about your construct that is really about the updating component that is missing from all these other more static constructs, right? So even, you know, rationality, it's like you measure it at one moment in time. You say, oh, well, that person has the my side bias, or that person suffers from, or that person's an active open mind thinker. But I think what you're capturing, what I like about it, and I want to highlight this, is that there's a dynamic aspect to what you're proposing that is missing in the psychological literature, because these things aren't studied in that kind of micro moment, kind of over time perspective. And what you're taking a more over time perspective, I think, is at least that's my interpretation.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think I like that line of reasoning, and it seems like it's a little bit what Phil Tetlock and his colleagues were doing when they studied perpetual beta in super forecasting. And said, look, you know, the greatest forecasters when it comes to predicting world events revise their forecasts more often than forecasters who struggle. And so there is an updating component of that, but they study that in a very specific domain, which is, okay, you know, is Donald Trump going to be convicted by the Senate or not, right? And then you make a prediction, and then tomorrow, how likely are you to either change your prediction or adjust your confidence interval around your prediction? And I want to know something much more basic, which is whatever you learned today or whatever you thought to be true yesterday, how willing are you to let go of that and reconsider it tomorrow?
Yeah, it's that letting go part that's like a letting go of a cognitive representation, letting go of like something that maybe is in our semantic tree, but we're like, you know what, I'm just going to ignore it as part of my semantic tree right now. So yeah, there's something there that is, you're really hitting on something important in the world today. And I want to link it to disagreeableness for a second as you talk about in your book, because as you mentioned, I have been, I would put it, I've been plagued by my agreeableness my whole life. But one of my New Year's resolutions was to dial down my agreeableness like 25%. I'd still be pretty a nice guy, you know, but 25% or so. And you, in your book, you advise, actually a couple of things I thought were really interesting. One is that you talk about the benefits of disagreeableness and how it contributes to growth via what you call a challenge network or challenge networks. So that's my first question about disagreeableness. Can you tell me a little about how that connects to challenge networks?
Yeah. So in organizational psychology, Eddie Jen and her colleagues have put this distinction on the map, which I found extremely useful. It's between task and relationship conflict. So when most people think about conflict, they're thinking about relationship conflict, which is the very emotional, very personal, I dislike you. I think you're a bad person. I can't stand working with you. And not surprisingly, that turns out to have all sorts of negative consequences for relationships, for teams, for performance. But task conflict is different. Task conflict is much more intellectual. We're disagreeing about ideas, as opposed to having some kind of personal animosity toward each other. And if you can have task conflict without it spilling over into relationship conflict, there's evidence that that can build creativity in teams, it can boost decision-making quality in groups, it can enhance team effectiveness because you're less likely to fall into a pattern of groupthink. And there's some evidence that agreeable people are so afraid of relationship conflict that they steer away from task conflict. And I can think of countless situations where I've done that in my life. I imagine you probably can too. And disagreeable people are a little bit more fearless, right? They're happy to embrace the uphill battle. They're energized by the tension. And so they're much more likely then to say, look, you know what? I really disagree with you. And, you know, the risk is that they don't pull their punches and it does become relationship conflict. The benefit is they're surfacing the issues that lead to task conflict. And so I guess to answer your question directly, I think that what I've noticed as I've analyzed this, at least in my life, is agreeable people have consistently been my best support network. They're the people who believe in me, who encourage me, who go to bat for me, who are my cheerleaders when I'm feeling like I'm not able to do something. But the disagreeable people, especially the generous ones, have been really a challenge network for me. They've torn apart my work. They've criticized my ideas because they really want to help improve them. And they've held me accountable to the highest standards. And so one of the things I did while I was writing Think Again was I identified the core people who had played a big role in my life as my challenge network, and I told them. And I actually, Reb was one of those people who's always, I don't think of him as a disagreeable person per se, but
he's honest.
His
he's
feedback
honest.
Has always been, he's very honest. He's intellectually honest. Yeah. Yeah. And he's always given me the harsh feedback. let me say that differently. He's always given me the tough love that I need. And so one of the things I wanted to make sure he knew was, like, sometimes I haven't taken the feedback well. Sometimes I've been too dismissive of it. But I desperately need it, and I really value it, and I consider you a core member of my challenge network, so bring it on. And I've noticed that since I've had those conversations, I get more constructive feedback because I think people have started to realize, oh, well, not only are they not going to hurt my feelings, but not only are they not going to hurt my feelings by criticizing me, they're going to hurt my feelings if they don't criticize me, right? That holding back whatever feedback they have is actually hurting me. And so I think we all need a challenge network. I'm curious, Scott, have you had a similar experience? Do you also have a challenge network? Have you formalized it at all, or is this too geeky?
Oh, it's definitely not too geeky. I have formalized it, but I've become really sensitive to another level here, which is almost think we can have a 4x4 matrix of good faith versus bad faith and disagreeable and agreeableness on the other axis. So we can have good faith or not good or bad faith agreeable people, and a bad faith agreeable person would be someone who's like sneaky. You know, these people who are like, they're nice and flattering, but they're not.
Yes.
They're
those are the agreeable takers for me. The fakers.
Yeah, the fakers. Good, good, good. So you see the 4x4 matrix I'm thinking of. But so what I become really sensitive to, I become sensitive to the bad faith on both the agreeable end and the disagreeable end. And I do try to assemble my network good faith, agreeable and disagreeable people, a nice mix, because if I have too much good faith disagreeable in my soul, I feel like I feel it's insecure, like I'm a loser. But you guys are right. Like, you know, I'm like, you're right. Like, you know, and, but can someone just say something nice about me? But then good faith agreeable people, you know, like your mom, like my mom's, you know, good faith. Well, she could be disagreeable sometimes, but God bless her. But you know what I mean? The people who are in the US. So anyway, I just want to add that additional layer there, because I do try to assemble a good, like 50-50 mix of good faith agreeable and good faith disagreeable people.
Well, this is one of the reasons that I've been so both, I would say, intrigued and also excited by the development Diebels and Leary and colleagues on selfishness as the possible sixth factor of personality.
Yes. What do you think about that?
I love it, because, as you know, I've long been frustrated by the fact that altruism and helpfulness and even compassion have been lumped under agreeableness. When I think at least the heart of agreeableness, as I've understood it across cultures, is really much more about harmony and cooperativeness, about getting along. And to the way that you captured it is really nice, that there are some agreeable people who are in bad faith, right? They might be deceitful or selfish or, you know, trying to flatter and charm. And there are some disagreeable people who are bringing lots of tough love. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that individual differences and selfishness might be a separate factor of personality from agreeableness and disagreeableness, I think helps to flesh out and support the matrix that you are building.
I really like that, Adam. And then that allows for interactions between the two, which is what we're talking about. So I like that.
Which is where we want to go. Yeah.
It's funny
that you don't want too many of the disagreeable people in your life, because maybe this is a way that our styles of agreeableness differ. So my biggest vice when it comes to preacher, prosecutor, politician is going into prosecutor mode. I can think of an embarrassing number of times where I was convinced that somebody was wrong, and I felt like it was my opportunity to educate them and my responsibility to let them know that actually the thing they believe is true is definitely false, and here's all the evidence for it. And strangely, that never goes well.
No.
But one of the things I enjoy about having disagreeable people in my life is they kind of naturally go into prosecutor mode quite a bit. And I feel like I have degrees of freedom to do that with them without worrying that it's going to cause relationship conflict. And so they become an outlet for that.
I hear you. It's almost like they empower you to be your full self, which is, so you feel free to express that. Yeah, I could definitely see that. I mean, I just like a balance, like a balance in my life. I really do like agreeable people. I find they're a lot of fun, on picnics, but maybe not so much fun when you want them to read your book and give you advice. It depends on the context,
So true.
I don't want to go on a nice, stroll on the beach with a disagreeable person, right?
Well, it depends on the topic of conversation.
That's true.
But to your point, I remember in grad school, I was working on, I guess it was my first major paper, and I sent it to a group of faculty and asked if they might be kind enough to read it and give me some constructive criticism. And I got amazing comments from all of them, except for one who was very into positive psychology and wrote me a page-long list of all the strengths of the paper. And I was so disappointed. I wrote back and I said, listen, I'm so glad that you see promise in this paper, but I know that's not the orientation that the blind reviewers are going to have, and I would love to get this paper published. Can you help me identify some of the holes and the flaws that they're going to find in it? And the response I got back was, I think this work is important and interesting, and I see no flaws in it. I'm like, no, that's not positive psychology. Now you're just failing at critical thinking.
I like this. This is a value that you have that I like. One of the values that you have that I like is you just like honesty. Like it sounds to me just at its base, all you're really saying at its base, if you cut to it, is you just don't like bullshit. You don't like, it's like, tell me what you really think. Yeah, I'd rather know.
Yes.
I'd rather tell me what sucks about my book. I want to know what sucks about my book. It's like this, what you're saying, that's what you're saying. Did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I think that's true. I wonder if part of that is sort of it feels a little bit, I'm just thinking about the way you articulated it. Mm-hmm. It almost seems like an outgrowth of being a high self-monitor, that if I don't know where I stand with other people or what their thoughts are about my ideas and my work, that it's very hard to adapt and address what they have to say. But maybe more importantly, it's also really hard to learn and make my work better, which is why I got into this field in the first place. So yeah, I want people to be honest. And I also don't want them to think that I have such a fragile ego that they can't tell me the truth. That seems like a great way to stagnate.
I think that could be it for sure. And I don't know so much the high self-monitor thing as, even a more charitable interpretation, that I'll give you more charitable interpretation of yourself than you just gave yourself, is that you really care about mastery. I mean, it's another way of framing the situation. Yeah. Even all the monitors, aside, is that you want to get it right.
That's exactly right. Yeah. You nailed it. That is mastery right there, Scott.
Thanks. Well, we're two psychologists talking to each other, which is, has made for a very, very interesting conversation. So we've been agreeing a lot today. I've been trying to find a way of like cheekily inserting, well, we'll just have to agree to disagree to bring up this question, but I haven't found that moment yet. So I'm just going to flat out ask, why do you advise against agreeing to disagree? A lot of people do that, right? But it's like they really still want to punch each other in the face. You know, they're like, well, we'll just agree to disagree. You fucking asshole.
it just happened to me last week when I was in a debate with a friend of mine, and he said, all right, we're clearly not gonna see eye to eye, let's just agree to disagree. And I wrote a whole book about why we shouldn't do that, so I can't just let this go. And I said, well, you know, it's to me that's a missed opportunity for learning. And let me tell you a bunch of the things that I've changed my mind about in this conversation, which maybe I wasn't clear about because I was so busy, you know, trying to make sure that you saw what I thought were the gaps in your argument, that I didn't tell you where you convinced me or where you opened my mind. And I'd love to see what, you know, what you actually rethought based on this discussion as well. And that to me rarely, I guess that's a casualty of agreeing to disagree is, if you agree to disagree, you say, all right, well, neither of us is going to budge, right? We have a, what's the old physics parable? You have a, is it an, I forget, what's the exact, you'll know this. It's the unstoppable force meets an immovable object.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And that's when we agree to disagree, right? It's like, okay, I'm an unstoppable force. Right. You're an immovable object. This is not going to do any good for our relationship, so let's just put it aside. We'll never talk about it again.
That's right.
The problem is, this is not the end of that conversation. Because I'm probably going to end up disagreeing with you on something else in the future, and I want to learn how to do that more constructively. I'm also probably going to end up talking to somebody else who has a view that's similar to yours, and I want to learn how to be more reasonable with them too. And so what I like to do is, when somebody says, let's agree to disagree, or when I feel that impulse, I want to say, you know what? This is a cue that it's time to stop arguing to win and start arguing to learn, and say, hey, Scott, tell me, did I say anything that was persuasive to you? And if you were making my argument, how would you rethink it so that I can figure out, you know, how to be more thoughtful, or, you know, how to be a little bit more, you know, more persuasive to somebody who doesn't see the world the way that I do? And I've learned a lot from having those conversations, and I think we should all have the courage to have them.
Oh, gosh, I love that. And I think that does relate to ways we can diminish prejudice. You talk about destabilizing stereotypes. How can we kind of bring that attitude to the table to destabilize stereotypes?
Well, I think you know the fraught history of research on perspective taking. I like the Nick Epley work a lot, 25 experiments showing that when people are encouraged to imagine the other person's perspective, they don't get anywhere near, on average, what the perspective is. It doesn't help. And in some cases, it actually hurts, especially if they're far apart, because you're much more likely to come up with a cartoonish idea of who the person is and what they're all about, because by definition, you don't understand them. So how could you possibly imagine what their viewpoint looks like? And I think the alternative is, I guess, to do, I mean, the real alternative, of course, is actually perspective seeking, right? Or perspective getting, as opposed to taking, right? To go and ask the other person, huh, I was really puzzled by this thing that that you said that I didn't understand. Can you help me get a feel for what was behind that? And as you know, in some experiments with Tim Kundro, we tried another approach, which is a little different, to say, okay, maybe you can understand other people better if you imagine yourself living a version of the life that they'd led. And so we asked Yankees and Red Sox fans and gun control and gun rights supporters to imagine how they might have held different beliefs if they had been born and raised differently. So the baseball version of this was easy. Hey, you know what? Yankees fan, what if you'd grown up in Boston? What team do you think you'd root for now? And all of a sudden, it's a little bit harder to essentialize those awful Red Sox fans to say that there's something in their nature that makes them root for the wrong team. Yeah. And you realize, okay, some of this is an accident of birth or circumstance. And this didn't make it into Think Again, but we just finished some experiments with people on opposite sides of the gun debate. And we said, look, if you're very big on gun control, what if you had grown up in a family that did a lot of hunting? Do you think you would hold a slightly different stance? And then for people who are big on gun rights, we said, what if you had grown up in Columbine or Parkland? What if there'd been a mass shooting in your town? Do you think you'd hold different beliefs about guns if that was part of your formative childhood experience? And we found that they actually showed less animosity toward the other side after doing that reflection. And I guess where that leaves me, Scott, is what I've started thinking is that counterfactual thinking is a strategy for reducing prejudice. To say, if I could rewind the story of my life and think about how if I lived in an alternate version of reality and I'd grown up with different people and different beliefs, I might actually be in a different position on this debate. Maybe I become a little more flexible and I see more flexibility in other people too.
Well, you know, I love this, but how do we teach this in schools and even like universities? It seems like, and I don't want to use the phrase cancel culture. They're just loaded words that I've actually been trying to stay away from these days because I want to just, but let's talk about the phenomenon we see on some college campuses where it seems like we almost reward students sometimes for resisting that way of thinking. You know what I mean? Like there might be some situations where students will say, that's racist, so I'm not going to take it. And you say, well, let's try to think it through counterfactually and different points of view before you come to that conclusion. And then, you know, let's have a discussion. Let's talk to people who might disagree, et cetera. What do you do in those kinds of situations where, like, we almost, you know, we don't promote that? Like, how do we teach that in schools?
I would love to know the answer to that. I think it's hard.
Yeah.
I think I would like to make a distinction between what often gets referenced in safe space discussions, emotional safety, and what in organizational psychology and organizational behavior we would call psychological safety. Yeah. I think that actually Van Jones has a great take on this. He says, look, I don't want you to feel safe intellectually every moment. I want you to be strong. Yeah. I don't want you to be bruised by every single idea that somebody brings to the table that you disagree with. I want you to be able to think it through and grapple with ideas that might make you uncomfortable. And that's what psychological safety is, right? It's the freedom to take an interpersonal risk without having to fear that you're going to get punished or penalized or canceled or retaliated against in some way. And I think that universities have a huge responsibility to build that level of psychological safety. So where I struggle with this is when I've talked to marginalized groups, they say, yeah, but then what if somebody makes a comment that is racist? Do I just let that go? And do I not challenge it? Am I, as a white man, I'm not sure I'm always the most qualified person to answer that question. But one of the things that I've learned from the research on this is no. What you could do is you can, instead of just immediately calling them a racist, you can say, look, here's why I think the view you're articulating right now is oppressing a minority group. And I think that's something we need to think really carefully about because I'm not okay with that level of prejudice or that kind of discrimination. And I think that skill has to be practiced in order for people to get comfortable using it. I don't think it's easy at all, but I worry a lot about universities that are starting to say, okay, safe space, you're not allowed to hurt anybody's feelings. Well, how do we ever learn? How do we ever take risks? How do we ever ask uncomfortable questions?
I mean, some people hurt my thoughts. I just thought of that. I just threw that for the first time. But
that's a great phrase. And you know what? Your thoughts should be hurt more often because that's how you improve them. Right?
Yeah. I don't never know what's going to enter my head in one of these podcast things. But I feel like sometimes people say shit to me. I'm like, you just hurt my thought. I really respect a lot what you said, and I think that this is where the good faith thing just comes into play. I feel like, you know, it is to any common sense person, it's obvious that if you have a white supremacist racist person foaming at the mouth outside of a context of academia, like on the streets or something, like saying, no, like there's no need to be like, well, let's exercise the skills of intellectual discourse and rethink, you know, maybe you should no, like that person's racist. Like, can someone arrest that person, please? Okay. But, yeah. But common sense also dictates, I think, that when you're in a good faith academic environment where someone is presenting an intellectual argument you disagree with, even if it sounds racist to you, it seems like there might be value in, if they're both good faith people, right, there might be value in discussing and trying to take it from the other person's perspective and doing some of the techniques and skills that you talk about. It seems like there's value there in doing that.
I think so too. And it makes me wonder if we can get more precise about what good faith means. So when I hear you say good faith, what I think of is, first of all, I'm not trying to insult or offend somebody else. I'm trying to express or work through a view I genuinely hold.
Yes. So it's not, I would also say it's not, they're not trying to hurt or it. The point is what I mean by good faith is simply that we're two humans here that are trying to ascertain the truth of the matter.
There we go.
I think of it in a Sam Harris talks about, he uses the phrase good faith a lot. And that's what he means is, well, we're going to bring two people together who their only commitment is to the truth, not to anything else. But the, at the base, the, yes, they respect each other as humans. I think that it's that combination of like yes, you feel like the person you're talking to, there's a basic sense of dignity, like kind of light triad, you know, respect there, but that's already given. Yeah. So yeah, I guess what you're saying is how to build communities that where everyone feels like they're psychologically safe, but also there's a shared commitment to the truth. Because I think sometimes you can have one without the other. I personally feel like, again, conversations with people where I don't feel comfortable talking to them because I don't feel like they're committed to the truth at all. I feel like they're committed to telling me their truth.
Yes.
There's a difference.
Yes,
there's
their
a difference.
Truth as opposed to the truth.
Yeah, yeah.
Huge difference between their truth and the truth. Yeah. And yeah, you know, it's interesting. There's a 2x2 that I drew toward the end of Think Again, which was crossing psychological safety with accountability. Which is something Amy Edmondson has done for years. And her argument, which I find compelling, is that if you have psychological safety without accountability, that you end up basically being complacent, where any ideas are welcome. And you're actually in an environment that's too permissive or too tolerant. You don't have quality standards. And if you add the accountability, or in your case, it's a commitment to truth, a shared commitment to truth, then Amy would say you get into a learning zone because people are comfortable bringing up a variety of viewpoints and challenging each other's thinking, but they share a goal of trying to get more accurate. Yeah. And yeah, I think that might be what we're looking for in schools, or at least in higher education, is to say we all have high standards when it comes to quality of evidence and argument. We also expect that there's a level of psychological safety for people to try on arguments that might be unpopular or might be considered contrarian in the spirit of them exploring ideas and also exposing other people to new perspectives.
And I think adults could use that training. I think before you sign up to Twitter, you should go through a training thing.
Like driver's training, Twitter training.
Twitter training.
I like this.
I think we need this. So yeah, I'll just end today with this phrase, dancing with foes. Thought that phrase that you use in your book really nicely captures a lot about what we're talking about today. But anyway, thank you so much, Adam, for the chat. I really, truly enjoyed this.
As did I. Thanks for having me, Scott. And I do have to ask you before we wrap, in the spirit of Think Again, I'm asking everyone I talk to on this tour, what's something you think I should rethink?
Oh boy, putting me on the spot on that one.
Absolutely.
Maybe rethink the extent to which you can divorce giving from empathy. Because I know we've had a discussion. This is a point of contention we had once in an email. We had a long email thread, I mean, a while ago about the light triad, dark triad, and I thought it had to do with, I think like the heart mattered there. And you said, well, what? And you actually raised a good point that got me thinking. So you might actually want to come back to me and say, which I'd be totally fine. I'd be totally fine with that, by the way. You know, you had made a point. Look at effective altruists. You know, They don't necessarily feel everything they're doing, you know, but I think that genuine giving really should have some sort of genuine for it to be genuine. I don't now see okay, look, Adam, now I'm rethinking me. This backfired.
This is not what I intended.
This backfired.
This is definitely not what I intended. Well, we should double click on this for a second because I think it's interesting. Mm. It's actually the funny thing is, yeah. I guess the argument I was making to you was the product of my own rethinking, which is for a long time I thought empathy was essential for pro-social behavior, for giving, for generosity. And then I came across the effective altruism movement, which had a disproportionate number of, I think, people who were probably on the autism spectrum, yeah. Who were trying to figure out the rational way to give as much money to charity as possible and say, I should not keep, it's irrational. I actually talked to somebody in the effective altruism movement who said something that really got me thinking, which was, he said, well, it's irrational for me to take a dollar more than I need of salary every year because there are other people who have less. And they're like, it's not rational for me to care about myself more than any other human. I was like, well, I'm actually not sure if that's true because there's a difference between individual and collective rationality, but it's an interesting argument. And then I read Paul Bloom's work, yeah, where he differentiated care from empathic concern and said, look, you do not have to feel somebody else's feelings, yeah, in order to have an interest in improving their well-being. And I started rethinking, okay, empathy is one path to pro-sociality. Maybe it's not the only path. So that was kind of the genesis of I guess, how we landed in that email discussion.
So
where do you come down based on what you know?
Yeah, now I'm rethinking everything I ever thought I knew about what I thought. But maybe you can distinguish. Maybe here's something. See, that I'm very wary of asking you to rethink something because my agreeableness is coming into play here because I almost feel like it's an insult because I don't want you to rethink, but think more broadly about giving because I think that it's valuable. Maybe you can distinguish between lowercase g and higher case g, but I don't think lowercase g is any less important. I guess we're both interested in giving, but I'm interested in like who are you by the way that you treat others every second of your life, you know, like as a personality trait, not as a strategy, yes, to be successful. And I guess if my advice to you about rethinking, it would be to think more broadly about giving, even if it doesn't make you more successful, more money or make you better in business. It puts a smile on someone's face, and that can actually be a bigger impact than you ever realized. You know what I'm saying?
I agree with that strongly, and it's one of the reasons that I felt like I was getting into such hot water when I was writing Give and Take, and then it clicked when I was finishing chapter one. Chapter one. I wrote this line that I was like, I hope everyone at least makes it to this line, where I said, if you do it to succeed, it probably won't work. To say, look, you know, just because there are ways in which success can be a byproduct of generosity doesn't mean if that's your goal, you're going to become successful. And in fact, that undermines the very spirit of being the kind of person who enjoys helping others with no strings attached, yeah, which is a paradox. But I think you've hit on a distinction that's important and that deserves some research, which, yeah, is, I think that when I was thinking about effective altruism and you were talking about how you treat other people, you're talking about what I might think about is interpersonal or relational giving.
It's like giving of your
and
being.
I'm thinking about,
it's like giving of your being.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Versus much more of the, I don't know, make a difference.
Right.
What's my impact question.
Yes.
And in the Schwartz values framework, I think benevolence and universalism roughly map onto those two categories. So I'm wondering if benevolence is supposed to be helping people that you know personally, your friends, family, close colleagues, right? Your trusted relationships. And universalism is the much broader concern for the out-group, or I should say it's much broader concern for out-groups, for the planet, for the world, for the future. I wonder if empathy is a stronger predictor of benevolence than it is universalism.
Well, I can look at my data. I have a data set on that. I could. I'll look at some point and get back to you.
Bring it on.
But I think that
I'd love to see that because
I'm going
to
look it up. I'll look it up and
yeah. Let me know what you find because I'm now even rethinking that and thinking, well, one of the ways you see universalism play out sometimes is concern for animals, which I think is heavily governed by empathy, and so maybe. Mm. Maybe it's not as simple as it sounds, but I think there's something interesting there in at least the basic idea that feeling empathy for another person changes the way that you treat people. But when it comes to your attempt to have impact at broader scope and scale, maybe empathy becomes less important.
Look, there are a lot of really interesting distinctions here. You know, you go even further and start to distinguish between universalism and universal love. like, because I distinguish between I distinguish between tribal connection and universal love in my book Transcend. I say that we don't distinguish enough between the two in the psychological literature. Actually, I also say we don't distinguish between belonging and intimacy as well. But just sticking to the one about universal love versus like tribal love, there's a paradox there that Paul Bloom points out, which you're pointing out. You know, you can have a lot of tribal love. In fact, having empathy for your political group actually is correlated with with political polarization. So there's something there about how empathy actually the stronger empathy you have for your in group, the more hate you have for your out group.
Yes, and that reminds me. I remember when I was reading Transcend, which, by the way, you made Maslow more interesting than Maslow made Maslow.
Oh, well, I don't know about
which
that.
Which I thought was an impressive feat. It was one of my favorite parts of the book is, you know, you took a thinker that so many people have been influenced by and said, "All right, I'm going to elevate him." I guess that's in the spirit of Transcend, but One of the things I was thinking about when you made that distinction was some writing that Todd Patinsky did a while back on saying, look, if you take positive psychology seriously, prejudice reduction is a pretty low bar. What we should actually be doing is trying to cultivate what I think he borrowed from Greek was allophilia, which was the love of the other or the love of the outsider. Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's a natural convergence between his ideas there and yours around universal love.
Absolutely. There's even some really interesting research Mark Leary has done on what if everyone believed in oneness. So he created a scale of like people who believe in oneness versus the don't. People who believe in that we're at its base, we're all one. They actually reported, and this you never see this, more love for outsiders than their insiders. It's actually a complete reversal of the whole situation.
Wow, you flipped the in-group bias.
It flipped it. It was the only situation that in the literature, psychological literature, I've ever seen that happen.
Wow.
I'll send you that paper. I'll send you that paper.
Yeah, would love to see it. Yeah. And actually, it's something we can cite in a paper we're working on and trying to reverse that exact effect.
Yeah,
through empathy, ironically.
Awesome. We could probably nerd out all day. You have probably 5,000 other promotions to do for your book. Look, I want to wish you all the best with this book production, with this book tour. It is a really important book for our times, and I think you've really hit on an important construct. So thanks for that.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate that. I hope you don't think again about that particular view anytime soon.
Probably won't. Thanks, Adam. Thanks for the chat today.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in on the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.